You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 233. Is features editor John Gentile. We're back on another brand new edition of the Punk News Podcast. We got a lot to talk about, a lot happening in the news this week. We're going to talk about old school stuff, new school stuff, middle school stuff, all kinds of stuff, because we've got a middle school mentality. And that guy laughing right there, that's the guy that works the decks, that mixes the mixes, that spins the tape, that records, that bends that vinyl. We are here with podcast editor and also reviews writer, Greg O. Simpson, Greg DeSimp. Greg, what's happening? What's happening?
Yeah, you guys know that I edited on analog tape, right?
Is that so?
Yeah, you know, I'm cutting, like, literally scissors, you know, scotch tape. Fucking like Beatles style shit. I'm like stretching it, sampling, all that. Little did you know.
And also, well, being that Greg is old school when it comes to tape, let's go to a new school guy, a guy that works with computers every day, a guy that can read zeros and ones like you and I read English. We are here with managing editor, the top dog, the Spuds McKenzie of Punk News. We are here with Adam White. Adam White, what's happening?
I had four different ways I was going to riff on whatever you were saying, and then you kept throwing in a different reference that had nothing to do with the prior one.
Do you write the stuff ahead of time, John?
And I just don't know. I don't know where I am now.
Spud McKenzie, go with that.
I'm completely lost.
Slurms McKenzie.
I know. Just too many things.
You're the Spuds McKenzie of Punk News, Adam. Dog that also drinks beer.
I go to Futurama with Slurms McKenzie.
Well, you know that's a reference to Spuds McKenzie. You know
yes. No. I know. Yeah, no, I'm old enough to know Spuds McKenzie, please.
All right, well, speaking of things that are old enough, let's just jump right into it, because we got a jam-packed week today, and we got some cool tunes to play, actually. We're going to play some old-school tunes. I think, Greg, you got a new school tune, right?
Oh, yeah, yes.
Nice. All right, so we got a real nice mix on tonight's podcast, action-packed. As you guys, I'm sure you all know by now, Blink-182 has had one hell of a week. Here's what happened about a week ago. Blink-182... Travis Barker and Mark Hoppus said that Tom DeLonge is no longer in Blink-182. We've got another show, so we're going to play it with Matt Skiba from Alkaline Trio at the Music Inc. Festival. It's like a tattoo and music festival. They said that they received an email from Tom's manager that said he didn't want to work in Blink-182 anymore and he wanted to do other non-musical endeavors. So they took that to mean that he didn't want to make any music. But Tom DeLonge fired back. Here's what he said. Tom DeLonge says, I never quit. They fired me. In fact, I had no idea they were going to send out this press release, and I was actually just emailing everybody about the upcoming performance when they sent out this press release that says, I'm not in the band anymore. So then, Hoppus fired back after Tom DeLonge said that he never quit the band, but apparently was kicked out. Here's what Mark Hoppus said. Travis and I and the whole Blink-182 organization have bent over backwards for years to accommodate all of the stuff that Tom wanted to try. It feels humiliating to be in a band where you have to be apologizing for one person all the time. That's how it felt for a long time. When Tom finally said, I'm not going to go into the studio or play this show, it was kind of a gigantic relief because at least he finally said it. I just wish Tom does whatever makes him happy and stops holding us back from what we all agree that we're going to do. Play shows, record music, continue this legacy, and have a good time doing it. I
can't even make through that sentence.
So apparently things are completely broken down in Blink-182. My read is that Tom DeLonge has not been responding to the guy's emails and hasn't shown interest in continuing the band. So the band just kicked him out. But he's saying, you can't kick me out because I'm a part of the band and I haven't quit. So there's a lot of issues here. The issues are, can they kick him out? What kind of partnership is the band? The other issue is, should Blink-182 continue? The other issue is, and I hate to be a hater, but who cares about Blink-182? They're not a good band. Like, this band is not good. Like, this band was cheesy when they first were around. They sucked.
Oh, so, I was a Blink-182 fan.
They suck, Greg. But go ahead, Greg. I'll pass the torch to you, and you can defend.
I was – well, okay. So last summer, I wrote a bunch of our, you know, 20th anniversary reviews, right? I did Weezer Blue Elm. I did Lagwagon Trashed. I was a Lagwagon super fan way back. What was the other one? Oh, Dookie. Fuck, I did Dookie. But then I did Blink-182, Cheshire Cat. And that was the only one that I didn't give a 10. I mean, I gave it a 9 because I admit that they were sloppy as fuck. I mean, especially pre-Travis Barker. Like, nothing against Scott Rayner, their original drummer. But when Travis came in, though he upped, like, the douchebag level, he definitely – seriously, I mean, just look at that guy. He is a fucking amazing drummer. I'm like, there's no denying that.
Is he really a good drummer?
Yes. He is. His technique is amazing. I mean, the dude – I mean, I used to subscribe to, like, Modern Drummer magazine and shit like that back in the day. When he first joined the band, there was some interview with him about how – I mean, he fucking, like, would woodshed like crazy. He was in marching band and, like, drum corps and all this fucking shit. Like, his technique is spot on. He just happens to look like an asshole, but he fucking – he's good. Asshole. Yeah, probably. But he – yeah, anyway, he tightened up the band a lot. But anyway, Cheshire Cat, they were sloppy, they were funny, and that's what I liked about them. I could kind of relate, you know, suburban kid, you know, no, you know, don't give a care kind of or carefree attitude kind of punk rock instead of the angrier stuff. You know, it was kind of a good juxtaposition. Anyway, I stopped liking them around Enema of the State because I was too punk rock at that point and they were too popular. The jocks started liking them. Got back on board maybe right before they broke up the first time. But anyway, I don't care about their reunion albums. I don't care if they never played another show, but I will still listen to probably, you know, Cheshire Cat and the one after that, Dude Ranch. And that's probably it. I'll listen to those still. Other than that, I don't care. So yeah, sorry. Long story short, I don't care if they play a show again.
I keep trying to think how I want to approach this because I was young when this came out, or when Blink broke. Let's go that way, right? So I was kind of like of the age that Enema of the State would have been like, you know, one of those big records when I was a kid, and it was for us for a while. Yeah. So, you know, but there are bands that I listened to back then that I can you know hop right back to and don't have to feel any kind of. I don't feel like, oh, this is you know, me doing guilty pleasure thing, or this is me, you know, reliving what was important to my youth, and I get that you don't like it or anything like that, but, like, I have never looked back at this band. Like, at the point when it stopped working for me, it was just, you know, it was just walk away, and that was it. There was no, you know, I have no nostalgia, I have no... you know, fond memories of whatever. It's just, you know, their reunion mattered not to me at all, not even on a curiosity level. So it's really weird just how little I give a shit about this at this point in my life.
So you didn't even – I streamed their – what was it called? Neighborhoods or something? Their one reunion record? I streamed it once. I haven't
heard the one before that. That was the actual reunion record.
Wait. They had two records since they reunited?
Yeah. There was like a self-titled one was the reunion one.
Really? Okay.
It was. I just looked on Wikipedia so I could be informed for this discussion about this band. Although despite you know, what's actually going on here, I'm looking at our article and – all that's jumping out to me, more than the actual circumstance, what's happening, is that Tom, I think it's Tom, in both of the photos that we have of them, is wearing a Macbeth shirt, and I'm pretty sure that's a clothing company that he started.
Well, I'm thinking like Shakespeare.
And it comes back to this. It just brought back this horrible era in mall punk where all these assholes started clothing companies.
Didn't Hoppus start one too?
Everyone that was in one of those bands has like a clothing company that was just made to sell like t-shirts to emo kids. And
Travis Barker has famous stars and straps or something.
Whatever, okay. Right? It's
Atticus. I don't know. So Atticus, is that a clothing company? What is
yes,
that?
Yes, yeah, Atticus that's, was one of them, right? Or it's just,
I think that's Marcus.
Do you remember all that at the time? All three or just of them. Like,
hot topic. Yeah.
Atticus is Mark Hoppus and Tom DeLonge.
Yeah, you couldn't just have a or so who owns Macbeth? Who cares? It doesn't matter. It just
Shakespeare.
Yeah,
owns it.
The ages own Macbeth. But
no one can own Macbeth. It belongs to the ages.
I feel that I'm so past the point where I want to like mentally give this band any bandwidth at all. So I'm just picking apart innate shit that doesn't matter to me. Like, I thought the fact that in their statement they said Travis and I and the whole Blink 182 organization. Like, what the fuck is that? You're a three-piece band. What, like the guy in accounting? Well, the janitor?
I mean, honestly,
like, I was eating pizza with Kara, and I was like, organization manager? I mean, we were confused. It was just 10 minutes.
This actually makes a lot of sense, and this underscores why this band sucks. Blink 182 is not a band. Blink 182 is a company and an organization. They've got tour managers. They've got accounts. They've got marketers. They've got people on their payroll. And that just...
You know the dwarves in Melvin's do too, right?
Do they have what?
They have people that work for them.
I guarantee you the dwarves do not have people on their payroll. I guarantee you the Melvins do not have people. I know.
They got roadies. Right?
No.
They don't have roadies?
Dwarves do not have roadies. No.
Really?
Melvins have one roadie.
Okay.
And but that's not somebody on your payroll. That's someone you hire for a gig. I'm saying
one roadie that you have is not an organization.
Yeah. No. I know. I'm
Dwarves and Melvins do not have marketers. Blink 182 has marketers. You know what I mean?
Right. No, I'm just being stupid.
That just undershows. This is just a company. But the music was never good. It was. I mean, I thought it was cheesy when it was first around. This music is not redeeming, and I don't know why the kids are so into it. I guess the kids are so into it because it reminds them of a time in their youth when they were more carefree. It's just not a good band, and I just don't care about this, and I really don't care about them fighting. I mean, what they are is they're a bunch of grown men fighting over money. They're not fighting over art. It's just a bunch of whiny babies. I mean, they're all multi-millionaires. I don't begrudge them for making money, but I mean...
to me, you know, I think there was actually... There is a certain age of person, and that I think, because I think John, you and I are around the same age. I think that are maybe a year younger than us. Like, it's really, really thin. It's like a razor's edge sort of thing. That some of this band's songs, and not the ones that are about dicks, mattered to them were like incredibly important to them as far as like being like an emotional teenager, and that created this bond that people have held on to. When I was getting into punk was probably when like I guess Dude Ranch was out, and so I remember what's the single from that, Greg?
What's My Age Again?
No,
from it's Damn It.
Damn It, right? So like Damn It was one of those songs that you'd hear around when they're like, you know, people had like punk tapes and stuff like that or whatever, right? Like that was one of those songs.
My high school band covered that song.
Yeah, and I remember a lot of people were into that before this band had any kind of cult of personality around it, people were into that. The year that Enema of the State came out was pretty important year to me, and I'm remembering a lot of the stuff that I was into at the time where there was a lot of recent, and I forget exactly when it was, but there were a lot of recent records from like Rancid and Less Than Jake. And like, I was a big third wave or ska kid at that point. But so there was a lot of that stuff that I was into. And I remember Enema came out and we're like, hey, cool. Okay. This is fun and silly and goofy. And I like Put My Age Again, actually, the single on that quite a bit, but then,
are hilarious
but then the timeline to me, it seems very clear where What's My Age Again came out. And I remember seeing that video on The Wedge, which is the show on Much Music that played like nothing but indie stuff after like midnight. It's the show that Damien from Fucked Up hosted for a little while when they revived it recently. So you don't play bands on The Wedge if they have any chance of actually making money. And this was one of these songs that they played there because, like, yeah, it was goofy and cute and they're running around naked and everything, but like, it at that point it was still a band that like no one seriously thought was going to make anything. But the All the Small Things video that spoofed all of the boy bands and all that stuff at the time. That was it was not so much for the sake of the song, because that song sucks, but it was a genuine, like, video hit.
Yeah.
Like, it clicked. It crossed right over to all those people in the mainstream that did listen to all of those bands that it was making fun of. And, like, as a piece of, like, as a marketing vehicle for the band, it was absolutely perfect. So, like, at that point, like, I'm going to sound like I'm any smarter than any of the other dumb teenagers at the time, but it feels like I stopped caring about that record right at the point when everyone kind of came in and started really caring about that record. And then, like, after all the small things, they were huge and they were everywhere. And then I think there were a lot of kids that came in that were, again, maybe a little bit younger than me, where what was the name of that song that was at the end? That was a kind of emo-y song.
Hold on. I'm looking at Anthem.
Song.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's track 7. I'm looking at Anthem's the last song. I don't remember.
No, okay. Yeah. There's a song called Adam Song at the end of there, right? That was, I mean, if you listen to it, like, blueprint for the mall emo stuff that came after that, right? Super emotional, super sad.
The next record, they had Stay Together for the Kids. That was like, they were like, we're going to do this emo thing.
Right? Yeah.
The next album.
So if you were the fucked up, vulnerable teenager and you were just at the right age where, like, a song like Adam's Song or Stay Together for the Kids was, you know, really going to kind of, like, help you through all those dark teenage times, or whatever. Like, I was listening to the Slackers at that point. But if you needed help with your, like, we were like, oh, I'm a sad teenager, we should go, you know, we'll go skank in the corner to this ska band. But other kids were like, oh, I'm a sad teenager, I'm going to listen to Tom singing about feelings, right? And if you were one of those kids, this band, you formed a huge emotional bond with them. At least that's my theory.
I just figured out, like I said earlier, that I dropped them on Enemy of the State because they got too popular. I just figured out this is what happened. Because I looked at the release date on AllMusic, June 1st, 1999. I graduated from high school in 1999. And, you know, our high school went a little bit into June, our school year. They were fucking playing these songs at my senior prom. And that's when I knew that I could no longer listen to them.
That record because, got really big. Really,
because I loved Dude Ranch. And then all of a sudden, all the fucking jocks are dancing, like the whole school is dancing to What's My Age Again or whatever. And I'm just like, fists to the sky, no! And then, like, I was done with them for years.
Well, like, I
imagine Greg, like, in his prom tuxedo, he dropped to his knees. No!
I had a purple mohawk that matched my purple tux vest jacket.
In my high school, this band was always a jockey band, you know? Or maybe not so much. Yeah, like, just like. Yeah.
Even in, like, 93, 94, I mean, this is 99 that this came out. Honestly, it really broke.
To be truthful, Blink-182 wasn't that well known on the East Coast in 93, 94. They just weren't.
Right. Yeah, California, but yeah, I could see that.
Go ahead.
Adam. No, I was going to say that that year, 1999, they played Warped Tour, and I was at that year's one. And me too. And I want to say, you know who else played Warped Tour in Buffalo that year? That it was, which in retrospect is really super weird, is the Black Eyed Peas.
That's weird. That's really weird. That is weird.
Whoa. But like that was like Black Eyed Peas before you know Fergie was in the band, before they like became this giant pop band where they were just kind of like a hip hop group.
Did you say Buffalo? You had to go. Yeah,
We went to Buffalo. We'd usually go to Buffalo, and every once in a while we go to Toronto. But the one in Toronto was sort of north of Toronto, which means you had to drive through Toronto to get to it. And that made the whole ordeal way longer than just crossing the border to Buffalo.
How long does it take you to Buffalo?
From where I live in Niagara Falls?
Yeah.
This is going to get really interesting for everyone that listens to this show to hear us talk about punk rock. You have to take
Route 17 and Route 43.
You take the Queenie.
That one that the Weaker Thans mentioned.
The border. You can either take the 190 or the I. No, okay. So the Buffalo from where I live is about a 40-minute drive, really. And depending on the day, that's including the border. So if I have to fly anywhere, I will go to the Buffalo airport rather than go to the Toronto airport. If we go to see a hockey game, we go to see a Sabres game, we don't go to the Leafs. Now, the other reason for all of this is that it's way cheaper flying out of the United States than it is flying out of Canada because we have crazy airport taxes up here. And it's way cheaper and easier to go see the Sabres play than to go to Toronto and see the Leafs play because rich people have all the seats to see the Leafs play. So you go to Buffalo, you can get in because it's, you know, it's Buffalo.
Macbeth Footwear is a Southern California brand of footwear founded by Tom DeLonge and later sold to Saban Brands, who owned the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. Moving on.
What? Okay.
Saban Brands owns Macbeth, and they also own the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers.
So tell me those are the only two things. Who else
played the Warped Tour in 1999? Eminem.
I mean, that makes sense to a degree. You know what I mean?
I believe I saw the Aquabats that year. I could be wrong. And
someone has made a handy chart about this that's on the internet.
There's your Blink 182 connection, you know.
Ice-T.
Social Distortion. Ice-T.
Ice-T.
Yeah, Body Count, probably. I think it was as Body Count.
Less Than Jake, The Living End. I remember seeing The Living End there. I was really excited about that. Who else? This is the Adam Reads a Chart part of the podcast. Pennywise.
Not the Aquabats? Maybe that was 2000. I don't know.
So anyways... Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, not the singer, but rather the Wisconsin governor, has been using the song "We're Shipping Up to Boston," which a lot of people think is a Dropkick Murphys song, which is not a Dropkick Murphys song, but they later record it. He was using their version during his campaign trail. Well, the Dropkick Murphys said, "Please stop using our music in any way. We literally hate you." Love the Dropkick Murphys. So there's two things to consider here is why is Walker allowed to use their music and is it funny that the band asked him to stop doing it? I guess this is not a huge story. People might say, well, how can he do it? And here's how you can do it. You can't play any band's music without the permission, period, ever, okay? And actually, unless it's fair use. So I take that all back. However... However, many stores, many things pay for what's called a broadcast license from ASCAP, from BMI. Up in Canada, it's what's it called, a Seascape in Canada or whatever?
SoCan
up in Canada. What those organizations are is those organizations are actually private organizations that have some governmental monitoring, but they're essentially private organizations. And bands and other people contact them and say, we want to be part of the group. That means... whenever a song is played on the radio, then they keep track of when these songs are played on the radio and pay you a little bit of money. Further, ASCAP and BMI, they sell licenses. For example, if you go to a dance club and they're playing music, that's not legal for them to publicly broadcast music unless they're paying for a license through an entity. That entity is usually BMI or ASCAP. Dropkick Murphys, because they're a larger band, are unquestionably a member of BMI or ASCAP or a similar organization.
I'm a member of BMI. A member of BMI.
There you go. So Scott Walker – but actually NoFX isn't, believe it or not. So Scott Walker, when he goes to these public places that have broadcasting license, he asks them to play Shipping Up to Boston. So essentially he's playing their song with the band's permission because the band has given BMI or ASCAP permission to license to play their song, you see. That's why he's allowed to do that. Now, obviously, Dropkick Murphys didn't say, we want Scott Walker to do it. They just said, okay, BMI, you pay for licenses. You collect money for licenses. You pay us a little bit of money. That's how it works. That's why Scott Walker is doing it. So now the band is asking him, stop doing that. So who's in the right here? Scott Walker is only, you know, agreeing to the contract that is offered by BMI or ASCAP that Dropkick Murphy signed. Or is Dropkick Murphy's in the right that they can say, you know, stop using our music for purposes that we don't want you to use it for? Oh, and we're also not going to tell people that we didn't write Shipping Up to Boston.
Can you fill me in?
It's a Woody Guthrie song. Oh. So it's not even a Woody Guthrie song. It was.
It's just a full like tune.
At one point, the Guthrie's family let the Murphys kind of like go through like Guthrie's like scraps and notebooks.
Wilco and Billy Bragg did that too.
Yeah, a bunch of artists have done it actually. So Shipping Up to Boston was, as I understand it, was a collection of lyrics that, or just like scribbles of a song.
Yeah,
I mean, if you listen to that song, there's only like one stanza in the song anyways, right? So it's like it's just a collection of stuff, eventually a bunch of junk that that Woody had written down that they took and they kind of wrote a song around. Because the song is clearly like it's clearly like the Murphys from a instrumental.
Yeah, it's like the accordion melody is like that's I think why it's so popular. It's catchy.
It is a pretty good song, if not a little cheesy, but I think it's a good song.
You know, sorry to get on a tangent, but I don't know, John, if you're into Wilco or Billy Bragg, but
no, I actually can't stand Billy Bragg.
Really? Okay. Well, Adam, have you heard Mermaid Avenue 1 or 2? That's Billy Bragg with Wilco doing the Guthrie stuff.
No, but I'll not be averse to it.
Yeah, fuck, man, it's good. Like they got from Guthrie's daughter or like granddaughter, like you were saying, had all these lyrics. They were lyrics. They didn't have any chord structures or anything. It was just lyrics, but they had like 30 songs of Guthrie lyrics that were unrecorded. They didn't know what they sounded like when Woody played them, but so they kind of reimagined them. And so it's like the Wilco is the band with Woody Guthrie and like Jeff Tweedy sings some and Billy Bragg sings some. It's really pretty fucking good. I mean,
I am almost positive that is identical to what went on with the Dropkick Murphys. Yeah. Like, I think the family kind of went out and kind of like went out. I don't know how they solicited the people that got involved with it, but they were like, you know, we have these notebooks. So someone makes something of it, which I really think is kind of cool. I mean, a lot of people for some reason begrudge the Murphys for that song. I don't think it's necessarily like their fault that, you know, the Departed made it incredibly huge.
And don't they play it at Red Sox? They play it at Red Sox.
Well games, I mean, right? they play it everywhere now. And I think people in Boston hate it because of that reason. But if the record that was on was it on Sing Loud, Sing Proud? I bet you it was. I have incredibly specific Dropkick Murphys knowledge that only spans 2 records, but for those 2 records, I know a lot. I'd be good at like a really esoteric trivia night. That song was not even like one of the centerpiece songs on that record. Like, I don't feel that it was a single or anything at the time.
But it was on the Hellcat sampler. I think that's why it became huge.
No, well, it became huge because it got picked up and stuck. It was like the theme music for The Departed. True, so Scorsese's music people heard it and, you know, kaboom.
Went viral. Yeah.
Went viral, yeah. So, what are we talking about?
We're talking about is Dropkick Murphys.
Oh, yeah, okay. They're not... I mean, yeah, they can't make a legal argument that he can't be playing the song. But I think that if you're a public figure and you're going to play any music at your event, you absolutely open yourself up to having that artist come back and hop on you. And it happens all the time. I mean, it happens like I think Springsteen has to do it like 4 times a year.
Yeah, because with Reagan, it was a big thing.
Yeah, every politician wants to play Springsteen music. Like that's how you show you're American, right? You got to have.
Yeah, the funny part is they often play "Born in the USA," which is kind of like not an anti-American thing, but an anti-government abuse song. You know,
it talks about killing Asians. What is it? It's "Kill the Yellow Man." What's the line in there?
I know the chorus. Boom.
Right.
Well, it's like I've heard that happen before with "Keep on Rocking in the Free World," right? Where it's like the people use it as like some sort of celebratory thing at an event, where it's like "woo, rock and roll," and it's like, you listen to that song.
Yeah, it's like a baby died in the garbage can is like one of the lyrics.
Oh, Adam, by the way, it is on Shipping Into Boston is on the Warriors Code.
Oh, it's on the Warriors Code. Fuck. Came out 2005. My whole trivia thing doesn't work. All right, never mind.
I think Adam pretty much summed it up perfect. I mean, pretty perfect.
Did I?
Yeah, I think you did. You know, I mean, if you're going to play a band song, you should probably be sure that they're cool with it and that it fits what you're trying to say. Otherwise, you're going to open yourself up for attack.
So, Scott Walker, if you're a Republican, just keep playing the Nuge.
Yeah, just play the Nuge. Just play Cat Scratch Fever every time you come out.
I will say, Scott Walker's a total – he's like on my number one enemies list as a public educator. He's a fucking dick. But, yeah, so don't use my music. You know, I made upwards of $100 off BMI licensing.
Did you really? That's pretty good.
I've been placed in a couple of documentaries. Outdoor Velour songs have been in shit. They're in licensing, you know, in the database. Shit.
Oh, that's pretty good.
$100 total.
Well, no, I mean, most people on BMI never see a single penny, literally, you know.
Yeah. So. Well, I have some help because the guy that I collaborate with, actively seeks out placements for shit because I contribute to his database. Like, we're kind of like a team thing, and Outdoor Valor songs kind of go into that. So he's helped push some of my songs, like pitched them basically.
Greg, to... we'll talk about that when we do the Greg documentary. Yeah. Moving okay. on, the All Sonics right. have put out a new LP. It's the first LP the Sonics have put out since 1967. And you might say, hey, John, who are the Sonics? The Sonics, a lot of people think the Sonics were punk rock before there was a punk rock. A lot of you might know the Nuggets compilation, which was a collection of early garage rock hits. I think Nuggets itself was put together in the 70s, but the songs are from the 60s. The Sonics have a couple of tracks on there, and they've got a couple of tracks on the expanded box set. The main, the big one is Strychnine, which really is like a, I mean, it's kind of like a Ramones-y kind of, it doesn't sound like the Ramones. It sounds more like Stooges, but the song is about how the guy likes doing strychnine instead of other drugs because he likes to get messed up in the head. So it's a
Psycho pretty, is my favorite.
It's a pretty wild tune. So anyway... Yeah. The Sonics are back with a new release. The new release is going to be called This Is the Sonics. It's going to have original members, Jerry Rosley, Larry Paripa, and Ron Lynn, and a couple of new guys, too. They put out a new single called Bad Betty, and I got to say, man, this new single was kind of kicking.
Yeah. I love the Sonics. And, I mean, the only thing that in the back of my mind is like, is this too much? Like, there, I mean, I don't know what to think. You know, with reunion records, it's like you don't want them to sound exactly the same, but you don't want them to sound completely different. It's a really hard spot to be in for a band and a fan. You're like, I don't know what to think. I mean, it sounds awesome, like on level, on like sonically, sonically with their old stuff, like the saxophone, the fucking, oh, what else? It's been a couple days since I listened to this, but yeah, it's great, and I'm going to go see these old dudes rock it in Cincinnati, I think. Are you going to go see them, John?
Yeah, I probably will, actually. They're playing Philadelphia, and yeah. I mean, this tune is kicking, man. I mean, if they play live with the intensity they play this new song, it would be cool to see them. I'd love to hear Strychnine live.
Yeah, you know, the way I would describe – you said Stooges, which I think is pretty good, but it's kind of like – I mean, the garage rock bands from that era, like everyone knows, you know – Wild Thing and fucking, you know, Louie Louie, which are basically the same song. But you got those bands like the Kingsmen and like Paul Revere and the Raiders. And like these bands, they were kind of more, I don't know, safe, I guess. And then the Sonics just kind of took that sound and just fucking like made it like go into the red, you know, just like amped up the vocals, you know, the screaming. The guitars were just, I don't know, grittier and louder. But yeah, they're fucking... I don't know, really important. They don't get enough credit. So hopefully this will shine some light on their older stuff too.
That now there was a version of the Sonics that was around in the '80s. It just 1980 oh, yeah. that released a record called, I forget. It has a super hair metal name for some reason. I don't know. Someone go look it up. It seems to be, it seems to be commonly not talked about. People really refer to, you know, the Sonics.
Cinderella.
Stuff.
Cinderella yeah. with an S.
Cinderella. Yeah.
What the fuck is that? Like sin, like
yeah, that's sinning. That's a pretty wow. shitty name.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, but if we want to go back and consider, you know, the last Sonics release in 1967 is the real last real Sonics release. That is such a time frame that I don't know if our normal reunion band logic can apply to even talking about this. Like, yeah. Normally, you know, it's Blink-182 got back after 3 years. Do we care about their new record? 1967 was a long fucking time ago. You know what came out in 1967? It was like Sgt. Pepper's Soul? Came out. Like, holy crap, that is a long, long time.
Yeah, fuck, man.
Like, that
67,
that is...
yeah, it was Revolver. It came out before Sgt. Pepper and Jimi Hendrix's first album, before Led Zeppelin's first album. I mean... Fuck, before Black Sabbath's first album. I mean, this is fucking, that's insane.
That brings up a point. This tune rocks, and you got so much mid-tempo, you know, Third Eye Blind punk these days. These bands should be ashamed of themselves. These 67, these 70-year-old guys are like, this is a song called Bad Betty. You know, and these kids are like, you know, like, oh, I remember when in the 90s when we had friends. It's like, it's just blowing these kids out the door. Literally, grandpas are blowing the kids out the door.
So I do want to ask you something, John. If Philly has the same, and Adam, if you're the scenes that you guys are in, I mean, really, I mean, we kind of triangulate this area that, like, you know, none of us, John, you lived in the West Coast, but the cassette scene and the garage rock scene in Chicago, Indiana, pretty much the whole state of Indiana, and I think partially into Ohio, the cassette scene has kind of gone hand in hand with this, like, garage rock revival, and not garage rock in the way of, like, they called, you know, 2000, like, oh, White Stripes, the Hives, you know, the Strokes, whatever. Garage rock is reinventing rock and roll. No, but it, like, garage in the sense of, like,
the OCs. They
love the Nuggets compilation. Like, people who, that's, like, their Bible. These kids, I mean, I say kids, like, you know, early 20s, all these young kids around here. Like, I just moved to Lafayette, but Bloomington, too, who record, you know, analog. They're not, you know, they're all old school, which has always been a thing for punk. But this garage, you know, ethos, this aesthetic, and releasing stuff on cassette because it sounds grittier, whatever, is pretty big. I mean, are you getting that in Philly? I mean, it seems like Philly's pretty strong on, like, not pop punk, but, like, I don't know, the orgcore type pop punk, rougher.
Not, like, voice. Philly is very big right now on, like, Waxahachie and that kind of stuff.
Which you hate, I know.
Yeah, I do kind of hate. But San Francisco is huge on garage rock. Probably the biggest in the world is San Francisco.
I can imagine. Yeah. So this is a good time. I'm saying basically this is a good time for them to reunite.
Yeah, I think it's gonna be a pretty big tour for them, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, cause yeah, that Nuggets shit. I'm telling you, like all these Lafayette people that I'm meeting, fucking. I mean, everyone's, you know, they're talking about it.
So. Speaking of guys that are paying respect to their elders, Ariel Pink has released a new video. The video is for the song Dazed in Daydreams, and the video is pretty wild. Well, it's off his new album, Pom Pom, which I loved. The video features Rick Wilder of early West Coast punk band The Mau Maus, who, I mean, that's about his first wave L.A. punk as you get is The Mau Maus, and they were a wild, crazy band. The main character in the video is Rick Wilder. He kind of plays the part of an aging punk rocker that works in a grocery store now. And also, the album has Don Balls of the Germs throughout it, and Don Balls probably contributes to the sound recording of this video. I guess I'll go last, but I gotta say, fellas, I love this album, and I absolutely love this video. This is one of the best videos I've seen in the last 12 months, I think.
I think that the video is incredibly compelling.
Yes.
I don't know why, but I was just totally transfixed the whole time. I'm not sure if it's the performance, like the visual, in it. I mean, the song is kind of cool. I like it. I have no context. I don't know anything about Ariel Pink, so I don't really know what all the controversy is about with this guy, one way or the other. I don't mind the song at all. It's, you know, I'm cool with it. But just the way that it is presented and the little narrative of this video and just the way it's shot, and just it's just good from a filmmaking perspective, I think. Yeah. I think that you kind of owe it to yourself just to go check this out. It's just, you know, it's good watching.
Yeah. John, would you agree, John, that this is one of the more straightforward songs on the album?
Yes.
I mean, it's a good choice. Yeah, it's a good choice for a single, and it's got a good kind of, you know, well, Cara was listening while I was watching the video, and she's like, this sounds like the Velvet Underground, or like it sounds kind of psychedelic and chill and stuff. And it's a good song. But yeah, it's definitely good for a single because it kind of turns you on to like the vibe of the album.
Honestly,
but it doesn't have the bizarre chop edits and shit like some of the other songs do.
Exactly, it's not as frantic as the other stuff.
Right.
It's actually kind of one of the more soothing tracks. I'll briefly explain. I mean, there's no real twist ending. It's really more of a character study than it is a story. The video features Rick Wilder as kind of like this aging punk rocker, and you just follow him throughout his day. And I gotta say, he looks old in this. I'm not making fun of the guy, but he looks old, doesn't he? I mean, Rick Wilder has lived some rough days, some wild days, and it really shows up in his face. And I think that's why that makes it so compelling. So he goes through his day, you know, and he gets harassed by kids. He goes to the store. I mean, he goes to his job in the supermarket, and his boss is mean to him. But then he kind of goes to a karaoke, and all the people are laughing at him. But while he's in the karaoke, he's kind of in his own world. I assume, and I could be wrong, he's kind of reliving his early punk rock days. And I think that alone is fantastic. But I think what really kicks this up is Ariel Pink shows up two or three times in the video. And it's almost as if Ariel Pink is looking at his own future, and that Ariel Pink now is what Rick Wilder was in 1978. And he's like, well, is my... And it's not actually Rick Wilder's playing a character, you know. So is right. Ariel Pink saying to him myself, am I going to wind up kind of this sad ending that this character in this video has because I'm living so wild now, or because I'm getting all this attention now, what will happen to me 40 years from now? That's how I read it. And I thought it was absolutely wonderful. Mm. And all, wow. And Rick Wilder is amazing in this. I mean, it's great. I think this is fantastic.
Hey, John, fill me in on Ariel Pink. Other than I remember whatever he said, something stupid.
Yeah, okay.
Not that long ago, but what, I mean, you're telling me like he lives wildly. I mean, is he known for like, I have no idea, is he known for like drug use or
well, I have no evidence whatsoever of, well, hell, I mean, put this way, Ariel Pink talks about having sex and doing cocaine on a lot of his albums. Now you can mm-hmm. say, does he do that in real life, or is that just for the albums? Well, right. you can decide on your own. I think it's clear how I've decided, you know. There's a lot of controversy with Ariel Pink, and frankly, it's completely blown out of proportion, and it's kind of his own fault. I'll briefly talk about it. A lot of people say Ariel Pink, he's a misogynist, and you say, well, why is he misogynist? People just say, well, he just is, and the answer is, I don't think he really is. And a little while ago, in an interview, Ariel Pink talked about how he wanted to have sex with this young girl. I mean, she was of age. So she told him all about her dad, and then they went to a smoothie place, and he didn't pay for the smoothie. So she got mad, and he like walked out, and she mazed him. And he talked dismissively of this girl. And so a lot of people interpreted like his mindset to be that he's a misogynist, you know. Now, he could have stopped it right there and said, I'm not a misogynist. This one girl was crazy. I'm not talking about all women in general. But instead, he kind of fanned the fires by saying uh-huh. nothing specific, but not saying I'm not a misogynist, or not saying I don't think all women are like that. You know what I mean? So it's he enjoys it, and actually that's part of the interesting part of his character, is he is kind of a dangerous character, you know. But I don't think he's a misogynist. I don't think he's a woman hater. I think he's a wild rock and roll guy, and that's what wild rock and roll guys do. And a lot of these and frankly, a lot of these uber PC punks do the exact same thing. They just aren't honest about it up front. You know what I mean? So I think there's a smear campaign against Ariel Pink, and I'm not saying he's a nice person. I don't know, but I don't think he's like a woman hater or anything like that. I think he's right. a rock and roll guy.
It's
like
most it's the rock kind and roll thing, guys are. Yeah, it's the kind of thing where like people who read punk news like these, you know, skewing younger and less likely to listen to his music before or after that whole thing, they're going to jump on that like, oh, I heard he said this thing. I only read like two sentences, but he said this. He's a misogynist. Whereas like places like, I mean, you know, Pitchfork, you know, you take it with grain of salt, whatever they say, but it's not like they didn't dump him, or like Stereogum didn't dump him. Like scenes that liked his stuff otherwise, you know, saw it for more as like an isolated incident, like you're saying. So like people that were already, you know, going to hate him, like your friend who reviewed it or whatever, they already had their mind made up. You know, obviously that's just, you know, fuel to the fire, where people who already liked him were just like, oh, you know, that sucks, but, you know, whatever.
So my advice is check out this album. This is a great album. Check out this video. This video is phenomenal. And let's listen to a track by the Mau Mau.
Stop.
And we are back. That was the Mau Mau's. Did you guys enjoy that early, ragged, jagged, nasty West Coast punk rock?
That was great.
Yeah. I mean, like I told you before we started recording, I never had heard them before. So, yeah, that was cool.
But now you have, because
we just listened
to that track, right?
We just listened together. We're sitting around on a turntable right now.
So let's talk about something that's up Adam White's alley. I know this is up Adam White's alley. The Specials are going to release an extensive set of reissues. They're going to reissue their first three albums, The Specials, More Specials, and In the Studios on March 30th, 2015. Each reissue will be two CDs and will include B-sides, non-album singles, rare tracks, and live cuts. The whole thing was curated by The Specials' own Jerry Dammers, and it's worth pointing out that there's two versions of The Specials right now, and a lot of the original Specials like don't get along at all, so there really is no one Specials anymore. So Adam White, are you excited for this, or I mean, are you specialed out, or is the first Special album enough?
Adam, are you special?
Are you special?
I think that it's sort of essential that everyone owns and loves both Specials and More Specials, sort of at a okay, Specials, More Specials, and like the Ghost Town single, right? So like between those three things, like you're pretty covered. There's cool stuff on In the Studio, so you can go do that if you want, but you kind of need those three things. And Ghost Town, admittingly, is probably sort of hard to find in like a contiguous form. I'm sure all those songs are on like a billion greatest hits records, so that they're like far from rare. But, you know, to actually just go hear what was on that EP might be a little bit of you may have to cut and paste some of your MP3s into a different folder sort of thing. not that I've done that and then went and found the original cover art and then retagged the MP3s so it looked like they all came. Thing. I didn't do that at all. But you could. And no one would laugh at you. So, but I don't know if I'm at the point in my life where I understand how to consume deluxe edition reissues of things anymore.
Oh, I love deluxe editions. I love them. I love them.
Well, like, I'm a person that owns like six copies of London Calling because every,
really?
Yeah, because wow. There was, because, well, I mean, at first you could get it on a CD and then you could get it on like the remastered CD. And then it was like the deluxe CD. And then it was like the like four CD deluxe CD that was in a little plastic slipcase thing. And I keep buying these things. But since I've been in my, I don't know, my postmodern, I'm just going to buy vinyl and listen to digital stuff. Realm where I haven't actually gone and bought a CD in a long time. I don't exactly know how a deluxe edition reissue would work for me in this case. Like, I figure like if it's on vinyl where I could go get like the original and then you're gonna like press like another disc full of weird stuff, then all right, cool. Whatever liked about deluxe edition stuff, either digitally or on CD, is that you sort of lose the original flow of the record, because you would get a record that would have, say, like 10 songs on it, 12 songs on it, and they would stick like, you know, 18 songs on the deluxe edition CD of it, where there would be no break, and that song that's supposed to be like the thing that caps the record ends up just basically like segging right into the, you know, here's the radio edit of our single again or something. And you're like, like this record should have ended, but it just kind of keeps going. And I don't know. I kind of like having the integrity of the original element. So, you know, if it's a collection where all the extra crap is on a different disc or on a different record, then fine. I'm okay with that. But again, now in the digital realm, I don't even know why it needs to necessarily even be packaged that way. You could just, you know, take the original, put it back together, remaster it or whatever if you have to so it sounds good. And then all that other stuff can just be made available, but doesn't have to be, I don't know, part of a package.
Yes, it does. Physical rules. Digital rules, man. Let me tell you, I've gotten into bands just because they had a deluxe edition of their CD. I've been in the store and saw a deluxe edition. I'm like, you know, this looks like a really well-done deluxe edition. Let me check it out. I got into the Go-Go's that way. I got into Men at Work that way. I love deluxe editions because they give you the album, and then on top of that, you get a whole bunch of extra stuff that you can appreciate like as like singles, and it really gives you a full idea of the band. I love deluxe editions. I mean, it's such a godsend for collectors because you have all the rare stuff together. You have it all at once. You don't have to pay a whole bunch of money to get all the different things. You have it all at once. Maybe you feel like listening to the album, or if you feel like spicing it up, maybe you listen to the bonus stuff, and it's you get to enjoy the album again without listening to those same songs. It's stuff created around the same time that's just as good or almost as good as the album.
I'm cool with that. I just want the bonus stuff to be on a separate piece of media.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I can't say there's anything I own more than two or three of. It's like it comes down to like my top two favorite bands ever. They might be Giants and Jesus and Mary Chain, which stuff like owning on multiple formats and whatever. But I do say that I bought the Jesus and Mary Chain's first two albums, Psycho Canyon and Darklands. I bought the deluxe CD editions because they are fucking awesome. Two CDs and a DVD of their like legendary early performances and shit. So that, yeah. John, you were a good salesman, like pitching fucking physical kids, physical still.
Greg,
a thing.
What's your favorite deluxe edition? Jesus and Mary Chain?
Yeah, Psycho Candy. The booklet, like, it's fucking like someone wrote a fucking thesis on how Psycho Candy changed lives in fucking the UK. You know, they were touted as the next Sex Pistols, but do you know much about Jesus and Mary Chain? I'm not going to go off on a whole rant.
Adam, what's your favorite deluxe edition? Well, I'll say mine while Adams think. I'll tell you, the Peter Tosh Legalize It Deluxe Edition is phenomenal. What you get is you get the original album, you get the unreleased Jamaican version, which is much more grittier, much more organic sounding. Then you get a bunch of demos which sound different than the album. Then you get all the dub cuts, alternate versions, and actually dub plates. If you know what a dub plate is, a dub plate is an extended version of a song released exclusively to dance halls and prints of like 10 records, 20 records. It is one of the it's the best reissue I've ever heard. Is the Peter Tosh Legalize It reissue. It's a 10 out of 10 album, and then you get it three more times, and they're all significantly different. It is an amazing piece.
Wow. Yeah, I really wasn't expecting you to say a reggae album. That's cool. That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, well, honestly, with punk rock deluxe, there's usually not a whole lot of extra material with punk rock bands, you know? The Alice Cooper Billion Dollar Babies one is really good because on one disc you get the album, and then on the second disc you get a whole live performance from that period, which that's really cool too, the Alice Cooper Billion Dollar Babies one.
So here's I just pulled this off my shelf because I've always liked it, and I thought it was going to illustrate. I'm like, I like this, but then it also illustrates what drives me crazy. This kind of straddles the line between like deluxe edition and box set, but given the band we're going to talk about, it's kind of both. Virgin, back in the early 2000s, released this Sex Pistols thing, which just doesn't really have a title. It's kind of called, like, I don't know, Sex Box One, I guess. It's a
Sex Box One.
I'm reading like all the little bits on it. But it's like it's a book. Basically, like that goes through like lyrics and stuff like that, and has like a little essay in it. And there's three CDs on it, and it's very nicely packaged, and it's cool, it's nice. But let's talk about like what's on the first disc here. Disc one, you would expect this to be Nevermind the Bollocks, right?
Right.
Well, it's disc one is studio tracks and early demos. So you get through Bollocks, and then you know, so okay, you're finishing it up, Pretty Vacant, New York, and then another, and then EMI, and then a bunch of B sides, and it all just kind of melds right from like the end of that record into a bunch of studio stuff or early stuff that actually happened before that record, and that's all on the same disc. So you have like the one disc has 20 songs on it, and that kind of like includes Bollocks, but. Nah, I don't know. That kind of thing drives
Bollocks,
me crazy.
Bollocks is supposed to end with Lydon making that farting sound, right?
Yes,
that's how it's supposed to end. That's how it's supposed to end.
So that farting sound happens, and then you get into the original analog master of EMI, and then it just, right? And there's all kinds of cool, rare stuff in this set. Don't get me wrong. There's a rarities and demos disc on here, and then there's, like, their live set from Screen on the Green is on here, and then a bunch of other live rarity stuff. So, like, it's cool, but it's just, like, I don't know, smushing it all in together, I don't find makes a great listen.
True. Yeah. Adam, how is that live disc sound? Does it sound good, or is it like another shitty lot Sex Pistols live, like, bootleg?
It's been a little while since I've listened to it. It sounds all right. The historical aspect of that concert probably makes it a little bit more important than the recording quality allows for, but I don't recall it sounding horrible, but it's been a while since I spun that.
Fair enough. Let's talk about some mod. Oh, I'm sorry, Adam, you have something else to say? Or?
No.
Okay, let's talk about something modern. Title Fight. The kids are way into this. Welcome to the Punk News Podcast, where we talk about Sex Pistols because we're trying to stay relevant. Let's talk
and
about
physical media.
Physical media. Let's talk about Title Fight. The kids are way into Title Fight. Title Fight just released a new album called Hyperview. They're streaming it, rather. It's due out February 3rd, 2015. This is definitely one of Punk's most anticipated records. Did you guys dig the Title Fight's Hyperview? Are you into the band Title Fight?
This Adam. Is sleepy.
Yeah.
I kind of support what they're trying to do. I get that they, you know, that the interest of the guys that are in Title Fight have deviated from being the melodic hardcore band that they were, or whatever you want to call their original sound. And they wanted to go off in this direction, but they didn't want to change the band's name or anything like that. And cool, like, bands take weird zigs and zags all the time. So, you know, if you want to do that and kind of, like, I almost think it's almost a ballsy move sometimes. Or you could really easily have just kind of, like, broke up Title Fight, formed a new band with everyone that was Title Fight, gave it a different name, and then no one's going to give you any flack if all of a sudden you know, start sounding like a dream pop act or something, right? But these guys are like, no, we're still Title Fight. It's just we're playing this kind of music now. And if you want to come along, great, it's a really crazy journey then. But if you don't, well then fuck you. Like I appreciate that. I appreciate that people do that. And I thought, given the circumstance here, that they went over to Epitaph, but they didn't sign to actually Epitaph, because it's a little bit, signing to Epitaph implies that we're still going to release another punk rock record, but signing to Anti implies no. This is going to be a different level of maturity than the kind of stuff that we were doing, which, if you think about it, is kind of what happened with like the Promise Ring, right? Not that the Promise Ring was super punk rock or anything like that, like, far from it, but when they released that album they released on Anti Woodwater, it was like a total change from the stuff that band was putting out before.
I was just listening to that album this afternoon. Fucking amen. So good.
I you know what? I love that record. I have no prior history before that record came out with the Promise Ring. I generally don't even like the genre that band plays, but I really like that record, which just goes to show you, if you're a weird emo band that Midwest people like Greg like,
hey, then we're gonna try to get Davey on in the Best Midwestern Podcast.
So if you're one of those bands, sign to a different label and make a record that totally doesn't sound like your sound, and then I will like you. I thought this was going to be something like that, and I guess it maybe kind of is, except that I really liked Woodwater, and this is just kind of sleepy. I appreciate what the band is trying to do, but their songwriting isn't hooking me.
Yeah,
so I don't know.
I agree pretty much completely. I don't have much to add to that. I like, band's growing, but meh.
Yeah, I mean, this almost sounded like The Cure to me, but without the dedication to melody, as Greg loves to say. It just the songwriting just doesn't seem to be here. But as I've stated before, this is symptomatic of a lot of modern music. It's more of an exploration of texture than it is of songwriting or songs or melody. It's really just almost like Loveless. Who's My Bloody Valentine? You know? Yeah. Except for it's not as edgy or as twisted as My Bloody Valentine. It's just it's very calm. When I listen to the Mau Mau's, for example, I mean, I'm on fire. Conversely, when I listen to The Cure, you know, I feel like what Robert Smith is singing about. You know, I'm like I really identify with that man. You know, with this, it's just like it's like a wave of sound, but it doesn't really – it's not compelling to me. But let us know how we're wrong if you disagree. Tell us what is so great about Title Fight, because as we've proven before, our tastes can change here at Punk News. So you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. But let's wrap up. We got a couple more short stories. One more short story here. The Mob, the legendary UK anarcho-punkers, The Mob, are doing a brief USA tour. You say, John, who are The Mob? Mob are a fantastic band. They were around originally from like 78 to like 80, and they were very unique because they're anarcho-punks, but they don't sound like Crass. They don't sound like Subhumans. They don't even sound like Zounds. They really sound almost a lot like sort of Joy Division or Gang of Four or post-punk stuff. They're a phenomenal band. I've seen them live once. Their biggest song is No Doves Fly Here, which is a beautiful, haunting song. So if you like beautiful, haunting music, check out The Mob. They're not a rah, 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 rah kind of band. It's much more cold, like Magazine or Joy.
I just perked up right there when you said Joy Division and Gang of Four. I'll check them out now. Yeah, thanks, John.
They only have one album, and it's called No Doves Fly Here, I think it's called. No, it's not called that. It's Let the Tribe Increase is the only album, but it's great. So The Mob is phenomenal. If you get a chance to go see him, go see him. I'm definitely going to go see him. Now let's wrap up the podcast by talking about – well, do you guys want to talk about the new band that's new or the old band that's new? Or do you guys want to talk about both briefly? All right, let's blast through them both.
I'm trying to like sort through my list. I'm like, what is John talking about?
Let's blast through them both. War on Women. War on Women is a very, very – hotly anticipated band. The kids are really, really, really into this band. They've got a new album coming out on February 10. The album is called War on Women. It's their debut LP. They've got a couple of EPs and demos out. They've released a track. It's called Pro Life. I dug this track. I thought this track was a really, really, really good song. But I've heard this before. This reminds me of pretty much all the anarcho and crust punk bands circa 88 to 92, you know. And so I put up on Facebook, I'm like, I dig War on Women. I think this track is cool. But what's new about this? And the general response that I got was, well, there's nothing new about this. But this is the first that these people... the people that are excited about this record, this is the first they've heard this kind of music. And so in a way, I guess that's good in that we're keeping this kind of music alive and introducing kids to War on Women. I would also add that maybe the reason War on Women is getting so much hype and, you know, bands like Misery or bands like Ayahuasca or all those kind of guys didn't get as much hype is War on Women is a little more catchy, a little more clean sounding, a little more rooted in classic punk rock or rock, while the other bands a little crustier, a little more power violence, a little more messier, a little less hooks. So I don't think there's anything particularly new about War on Women, but the music is good, and it seems to me that the reason there's so much hype behind this band is because people haven't really heard of the crust and hardcore bands from 88 to 92.
It's maybe like a gateway band, right, to like those kind of...
Yeah, but I don't think it will be a gateway. I think people just love this band, but they won't go research, you know? But but I mean, it's a cool track. I'm not hating on the band. I guess it's just frustrating for me, I guess. People are like, oh, War on Women is so great. And then I'm like, well, how about you go listen to Amoebix then? You know what I mean? Like Amoebix is like the greatest like crust punk band ever, you know, and people don't even know about them. But they're like, oh, War on Women's great. There would be no War on Women without Amoebix and a lot of other bands too, mind you. But, you know, I mean, that's not this band's fault. This band is just kind of playing the music they like. So I can't penalize this band because their fans aren't, you know, into the old stuff that influenced them. You know what I'm saying? Do you understand my frustration?
Yes. So you think that these guys and gals, do they listen to Amoebix?
Well, I don't know about Amoebix per se, but I can almost guarantee you that they are well-versed in crust punk and hardcore circa 88 to 92.
Yeah, yeah.
Slug and Lettuce kind of stuff.
I don't know what that means.
Oh, that was like a fanzine that was around. They covered all of this kind of music, you know, co-op stuff. What a famous punk rocker who I won't name caused the quote vegan bake sale, if you will.
I can't begrudge this band for, you know, for maybe not necessarily, well, you know, for playing a sound. I mean, people said, you know, when Rancid was around, everyone was like, this is just the Clash. And but all the see, old people Rancid, complained about that.
Rancid really isn't just the Clash. I disagree with that, to tell you the truth.
Well, no. I mean, I do too. But, I mean, you can, you know, give this band some time to grow and do stuff.
Yeah, but, yeah, I mean, I don't know why. I seem to have a chip on my shoulder about this band. And it's not the band's fault at all. They make good music that I enjoy, you know? So I'll go see him live for sure. So and then I'll report back. How about that? I will report back after I see this band live. Let's wrap
up. So hey, before we do, while we're talking about new bands, could I go ahead and play my shit I'm gonna play? So a new band.
Well, why don't we just do the last news story and then play it? Unless you want to play it right. Yeah, we'll do the story and then we'll play it.
Go ahead.
So the Lookouts are re-releasing their only LP, and I think you're going to have some bonus tracks on it too. You say, John, who are the Lookouts? The Lookouts were the pre-Green Day band featuring Trey Cool, Larry Livermore, also who's Larry Livermore also in? Crimpshire? Was Larry Livermore in Crimpshire? Mm-hmm. I should know this. And Kane Kong. Well, and so they're re-releasing their material. I think it was recorded in like 87 or maybe 86. At the time, Trey Cool, if you look at the picture of Trey Cool, he looks like he's about 12 in this picture, you know? So they're re-releasing it out on Spy Rock Road. Oh, no, the album's called Spy Rock Road. Don Giovanni is re-releasing it. The people are seem pretty excited about this as an artifact, but also people seem excited about the music. They've released a single. The single is called Story. Did you guys dig this single? Are you guys excited for this? Is this an interesting footnote?
I just want to tell you, another band he was in was called The Potato Men.
Who Larry Livermore was?
Yeah, I've never heard of that band. Livermore and Patrick Hines.
Oh, he was never in Crimpshire. I'm wrong about that.
In 92, the Potato Man, a pop punk band, released two albums. Yeah.
I mean,
go ahead.
I mean, this is fine. The Lookout stuff has never really super appealed to me, and it was always really more interesting in that that this was a pre-Green Day act. There's a lot more, you know, interesting stuff from that kind of like early Lookout Records era than this, but hey, I mean, it's cool that it's back out. It's sort of interesting that all the legal tape that the Lookout catalog has gotten snarled up in appears to be letting some stuff through now.
Oh, I don't think it's a question of that. I think it's a question of they can't do anything. I don't think that Lookout necessarily had contracts back then, or I don't think that they signed contracts. Actually, no, who knows what really happened, but the fact is Lookout owes everybody royalties. There's nobody Lookout doesn't owe royalties to. So if they breach their contract, you can probably take your album back. So that's what Green Day did. That's what Operation Ivy did. That's probably what the Lookouts are doing. You know what I mean? Because if Lookout sues the band, then the band can say, okay, where is our royalties from the past 30 years? You know? So.
Well, isn't it because he... I mean, he co-founded Lookout Records.
Yeah, but he sold his share. So if he sold his share,
then
he no longer has any interest in it whatsoever. There's actually there's a whole article about that you can find actually at this Lookout at our post. It's on East Bay Express. It's the entire fall of Lookout, and it really is an interesting article.
Yeah, and we had him on a Let's Do It Live. We had a interview, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't we have him on?
Yeah. I think the failure of Lookout, though, is not Larry Livermore's fault. He left before the label stopped paying royalties. So, I mean,
right.
I'm just looking to not cast aspersion on Larry Livermore, you know.
Yeah. I love that picture of Trey Cool. That fucking
– He looks
Trey
like he's 12, cool you know what I
picture.
Mean?
I think he is. He was 16 when he was in Green Day, so he was super fucking young.
Yeah.
That's so funny. And someone in the comments said Trey Cool or Rachel Dratch.
Who's Rachel Dratch?
She was on SNL. There is a resemblance. she's kind of an odd looking woman. She's hilarious. So,
well, there you have
anyway,
Adam, any last words, Adam?
No, I'm trying. I'm trying to get back to the article so I can see if Trey Cool actually does look like Rachel Dratch because.
I'm looking up Rachel Dratch right now.
You don't remember Rachel Dratch? Like, where were you when
she was on 30 Rock a bunch of times?
I've never seen 30 Rock, honestly.
Oh,
I don't think she looks like Trey Cool. You people are mean. She's a perfectly fine looking woman. There's nothing wrong with Rachel Dratch.
I feel bad about that. She's awesome.
People saying Ariel Pink is misogynist. You guys are misogynists.
She Hey,
it's misogynist, you know, to say that someone looks like Trey Cool.
In King of Queens, which is totally not a cool show to reference, Rachel Dratch played a pretty big part dating Patton Oswalt's character, which is kind of funny when Patton Oswalt was in a sitcom. So, yeah. Anyway.
Anyways, Greg, play us a song.
Yeah, okay. So we're talking about new shit. This is like the newest of the new. Of course, I'm, you know, repping on Midwest stuff and my old hometown of Bloomington. I'm going to play a band called Poor Islero. And Two Greg's One Podcast, back when we were doing that thing, reviewed the drummer's old band called The Size of Color. And this is something they'd probably only be known in Bloomington. But Poor Islero has a little bigger draw because the drummer's brother was in a band called Kentucky Nightmare. Again, neither one of you guys would have heard of them. But as far as regional, even outside of Indiana, I think they'd have some Midwest recognition. So, Poor Islero, this album, he just sent it to me, like, seriously, I got it like 3 days ago, because we reviewed his old band, so now he's like, you know, we got Best Midwestern going, keeping the Midwest thing rolling. He's like, hey, you know, you want to, you know, do this? It hasn't even come out yet. I mean, I think it may be coming out by the time...
Does this story go anywhere, Greg?
By the time this podcast is live, I think it may have come out. So Poor Islero, it's like guitar freak out stuff. I mean, fit under the realm of indie rock, but loud fucking guitars and melodic vocals. So Poor Islero track I'm going to play is fucking Pimp Go by Poor Islero.
Up from the dead to join the human race. Fix my haircut, draw some lines across my face. Get busy making friends with the plates. Start smoking, take what looks neat and took. Check pulses, drive someone's daughter. I don't see my life.
back. Greg, you mentioned Best Miss Winter. I can't even say the name of your fucking podcast now.
Sorry.
Best Midwestern. Yeah. Can you tell the people what that is? Because I don't think we've mentioned it on the show before.
Sure. Yes. Two Gregs, One Podcast. I was doing with my buddy Greg Moore. He decided to pack it in. He's going back. He's taking classes again to finish his degree and whatnot. So he's like, I think, you know, I'm out. You know, it was fun. We did it for 3 years. So I want to keep, you know, pushing Midwest stuff because the coasts get all the attention. Fuck you guys. No, but anyway, so Scott Heisel, who you're going to have to kind of correct me on the story here. I'm a good friend of Scott Heisel from college, but he was one of the original three. Yes, Adam, for Punk News.
There may have been some people before me and Scott signed up, but
okay,
they're not important.
So
no one remembers who they are.
The three that made Punk News kind of, you know, what it became, right? Got to start rolling. So he did shitloads of reviews and editing and all that for the site back in the day. And he left to work for Alternative Press magazine. He worked his way up through editor, and he was like the head editor. He worked there for a decade. And now he's going to be doing the podcast with me. He's a Midwesterner, born in Rockford, Illinois, lives now in Cleveland. So I'm pretty excited because we know each other really well. He did a reading at my wedding, all this. So we know each other really well, and we both talk a lot, and he is loud. So it's going to be really fun. Our first episode, we're recording it in a week. It should be out, you know, a little bit after that. So you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/bestmidwestern, and Twitter @bestmidwestern. Yeah.
All right. I don't know why I put a weird pause there. Anyways, yeah, we're done. if anyone wants to email us, it's podcast@punknews.org. John, any parting words for the people?
Check out that Ariel Pink video. Check out the Mau Maus, baby.
All right. I guess we're done. We'll see you guys in a week.